Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 14 of Logicast, the AWS News podcast brought to you by Logicarta. I'm Carl Robinson, CEO and co-founder of Logicarta, and I'm joined today, as always, by my colleague, John Goodall. I say as always, he actually had a week off last week. How are you doing, John, after your week off last week?
I mean, I may have had a week off, but so did the podcast. So
yeah, you didn't have a week off. You're never getting a week off the podcast. So, the podcast had a week off because John had a week off, so...
Yeah, not too bad. In typical British fashion, I did DIY. Changed the sink in the bathroom. That was an experience. Not looking forward to doing that again. Resealed the bath, replumbed the fridge, did various other minor bits and pieces. So if this internet thing packs up, I'll be a plumber instead. It'd be fine.
You're acquiring some other skills. We did promise the listeners a sync update a couple of episodes ago, I believe. So they'll be pleased to hear that you've finally got around to sorting out your sink.
It's all in. I did, however, learn that a 32mm waste pipe is not a 32mm waste pipe.
Oh. What is it?
It depends if you're using push fit or solvent weld. The solvent weld 32mm waste is actually 36mm.
Well, there we go.
And they're not interchangeable, and they're not labeled very well in most shops. So you do need to look.
I'm sure the listeners will be pleased to have picked up that tidbit from an AWS News podcast. There we go.
Also, use plumber's mate, not flange valves, because they're not flange washers, because they're rubbish.
You just wanted to say flange on the podcast, didn't you? Anyway, we're also joined today by a very special guest. Sorry, Ed, I didn't mean to talk over you there, but I need to introduce you before you speak. Yeah. So we're also joined today by fellow AWS community builder and AWS user group leader, Ed Krask. How are you doing today, Ed?
Yeah, not too bad. Relative novice on this whole pod, video, cast, whatever you want to call it thing. So doing the faux pas of stepping over you as my first thing on the show is always good.
That's okay. We do it to each other all the time. And as I said, we're 60-odd episodes in and we still haven't got the hang of that. But tell us a bit about yourself, Ed. What do you do for a living, and what are you doing in the community?
I'm a cloud professional services consultant at BGSS, based up in Leeds, and I run the Leeds AWS user group, and I'm also an AWS community builder.
Cool. Which category?
That's a good question. Cloud operations.
Ah, yes. The catch-all. I'm also in the catch-all category. So, jack of all trades, specialist of none. So, it's a good category to be in because it's the one I'm in. So, welcome to the category.
You know, you can change. It's allowed.
Oh, you can apply to be in a different one. Yeah, well, you have to write some content or generate some content about something specialist in order to get into another category, I guess.
Yeah, I need to get better at generating content. I think that is the long and short of things when it comes to builder thing. But there we go. You know, here's a little bit of content.
Absolutely. Have you submitted your renewal application?
Yeah, because this is too late.
Yeah, it'll be too late otherwise. But there we go.
Well, good luck with that. We all got our fingers crossed about getting renewed into the Community Builder Program for another year. Tell us a bit about your user group.
I can still run the user group, so there we go.
That's true.
God knows how long it's been going for right now. I didn't actually start it. I took it over because there was some people from another company based in Leeds that got too busy doing other things and found that it was best to pass the mantle on. But I'm definitely not the only person involved in running the user group. Got quite a big team of people now. Find it a lot easier to do it that way and take it in turns at hosting and finding speakers and all that fun stuff that I'm sure you're fairly familiar with as well.
Well, we're becoming more and more familiar with it. We're about to run our fifth Brighton user group meeting in May, and might pick your brains later about how you've built your team, because at the moment the team is John and I, so it might be good to have some more people involved in helping us out with that. But
yeah, I can certainly chat a bit more about that later.
Nice. Sounds good. Okay. Well, we're not here to talk about John's plumbing or about Edge User Group. We are here to talk about AWS news. And regular listeners to the podcast will know that every week I collate a list of AWS news in my weekly AWS News Roundup newsletter. And then John and I select a subset of those articles that we'd like to talk about with our guest on the podcast. So we do, of course, have a selection of articles this week. And the first one is a new feature announcement on the AWS website. And it's all about about AWS Compute Optimizer, which has introduced memory customizability for EC2 right-sizing recommendations. So EC2 right-sizing, firmly in our wheelhouse, John. Is this a good feature? Is this something we're going to be using?
Oh, yeah. This is. So, right, let's do some, before I get too excited about what is fundamentally quite a dull thing, but it's interesting to me, even though I'm a serverless CB, so I shouldn't even care about these sorts of things. But, you know, you pay me to care, so I care. Right, let's do some definitions. Compute optimizer. That is, it does what it says on the tin. It looks at your compute resource, primarily EC2, but it does a few other bits and pieces, Fargate and arguably Lambda, to sort of say whether your resources are under or over or adequately provisioned. And it does that based on a number of metrics, depending on the service. Now, to date, EC2, that's been a little bit limited because it's just been CPU, because that's kind of all it had access to, because that's all that's available at the kind of control plane level, to pinch a Kubernetes term. Excuse me. What this does is if you add a CloudWatch agent or an other observability tool, others are available. I've not checked what they are, but there's plenty. It will also look at memory allocations. Now, that's important. That's interesting because a number of applications are memory bound rather than CPU bound. So you might have absolutely loads and loads and loads of CPU allocation, and you're absolutely fine on that. And up to till now, Compute Optimizer is saying, yeah, this is fine. I can't see a problem with this. But your app has got nowhere near enough RAM and it keeps falling over. Java applications are particularly guilty of this, and Tomcat and that kind of thing. They're quite guilty of this because they will grab a big heap of memory and then just kind of operate, but they might keel over on you. And you've not really quite understood why. This is good because there's now a way of getting that data into a tool that will tell you, oh, hang on, you're using 95% of your RAM. Is this intentional? Should you be, you know, is this a cache? Is this Varnish, for instance, which grabs all the memory it can at boot time? Is this something like Redis that you're running because you're an idiot and you're running Redis directly and you've not configured it properly? So it's just gone increased and increased and increased and increased, and it's not kind of sat there and captured the amount, or kind of, you know, what's going on. So this is good, like this. A little bit annoying that it's agent-based, but that kind of can't be helped because memory isn't available at the control plane level for anything. That's why to get any kind of RAM metrics, you have to install CloudWatch agent, or for monitoring like a Datadog agent or a New Relic agent or whatever. But yes, like this, more data is good. It's not available in China or GovCloud, so sucks to be you if you're running in those regions. But other than that, use it. Great. No complaints.
How about you, Ed? Is this relevant in your world?
Potentially. I think it's one of those things. It sounds good. Definitely makes sense to have that. And certainly, if you're caring about your EC2 instances, you are wanting to monitor how much memory they're using one way or another. So if you can get that into the Compute Optimizer tool, then it can actually base its opinion on that, then that's pretty good. I think this is still restricted, as far as I can tell, to non-autoscaling group instances, because Compute Optimizer doesn't seem to run on those, which kind of limits what you're monitoring. If you've built like a modern scalable application, then you're still going to potentially not have it telling you whether you've kind of right-sized there. But I guess the whole point of auto-scaling is it scales out of your right-sizing issue anyway, but you kind of probably have to look in a bit more detail at your auto-scaling metrics and figure out what's going on there to get things optimized in that situation.
Well, that's an interesting one, because the idea behind Compute Optimizer is you don't know what you don't know, so you just let the tool tell you, oh yeah, you haven't got enough CPU, oh, you haven't got enough RAM. Whereas something with a scaling group, the idea, yes, it scales out of the capacity problem, but you need to know what metric to scale based on.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, you could be scaling based on RAM, but with the wrong instance type. So if you're scaling RAM on a compute optimized instance type, then that's not going to be optimized, I guess. I said optimized there a lot. I perhaps could have interchanged that with another word to explain myself a little bit better. But
let's just pretend you interchanged it with two different spellings. It'd be fine.
Yeah, well, it was an English optimized and an American optimized. So yeah. Some listeners will know the difference, some will not. It's definitely an interesting point. Were you aware of that, John, that Computer Optimizer can't optimize ASGs?
Not off the top of my head. It's not something I use hugely sort of day to day. It's because we have kind of other tools and stuff that we use for this, and we do a little bit of right sizing, but not masses. But it's certainly worth knowing about.
Yeah, I got tasked with running it before across over 200 AWS accounts, and I was expecting it to just give me a massive ream of things to optimize. And it was like, you've got a couple of EC2 instances here and there. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I realized that actually a lot of the instances that I was expecting it to bring up were like in autoscaling groups, and it wasn't going to show me them. So I was like, oh, there we go then.
Well, sounds like this is turning into a feature request rather than an announcement.
Now we just need to find a friendly sysadmin somewhere, a friendly solutions architect. That's the other I say.
I'm sure we can feed it back. Yeah, feed it back through Community Builder Slack while we're still community builders.
Make most of it while we can.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. On that note, let's move along to our next article for this week, which is another AWS feature announcement. And this one is announcing per second billing for EC2 Red Hat Enterprise Linux-based instances. Effective April 1st. I'm not sure if there's an April Fool, though. Did we check that this is genuine, John? Because it was effective April 1st. So not the most hilarious April Fool I've ever been. But you've got to be careful, mate, reading announcements that are effective on the 1st of April.
Some would say you're a fool for running Red Hat anyway.
But oh, that's controversial. But Go on then, expand on that, Ed, seeing as you've dived in.
Well, I mean, just looking at it from a purely cost point of view, you're going to be paying quite a bit more than just running, a free Linux on your instances. And, there might be strong reasons for that. You might make good use of the extra support you get running Red Hat. You might have such a platinum tier service that you need that extra coverage and you need to know that things are well tested and all that kind of fun extra stuff that you get for all that money. But for most things you probably don't need to be paying for that, and it's just a whole load of extra cost. And the way I was thinking about it was the people most likely to be running Red Hat are also the people least likely to benefit from per second billing, because they're probably running their instances all the time anyway. Maybe there isn't that large a subsection of AWS customers that are going to benefit from this, but clearly, given they've bothered to do it, there must be someone complaining loudly enough to have made them implement it. So there we go.
Yeah, so somebody somewhere has asked for it, and we've spoken about this on the podcast a number of times. It's probably one enormous customer that needed satisfying.
I could probably work out who it is. Really? Who it is. I think it's the London Stock Exchange.
Have you been out there long enough to say that now?
I mean, yeah. I left there in like 2019 or something. But they ran Red Hat, because specifically this was FTSE that I worked for. They ran Red Hat. That was all the VMs on-prem. And because everything was built on Red Hat and they had big Red Hat support and all the rest of it, it was, we use Red Hat in the cloud, because that's kind of what we've got and that's what we're used to, and that's what all of our scripts are built in. Because if you move from a RHEL type distro to an Ubuntu or a Debian type distro, all of your packages change, all your package management changes, and it's just a pain in the backside. So cool. Per second billing, I like that. It's not surprising that it came to RHEL kind of fairly late in the day, because I think it's been around for a number of other distros for a while. But I like that. I like that a lot.
I'm wondering if another reason to be a Red Hat customer is to get one of their fetching red fedoras at conferences, or do they give them out to anybody? I've never actually tried to get one.
No, they give them out. It's the same as the HashiCorp socks. You've got to be in the right place at the right time.
Right. Yeah. I've never actually tried to get hold of one of those, because I would obviously never wear it again after the conference. Perhaps some people do, each to their own. Anyway, on that note, let's move off of Red Hats and onto the next article for this week, which is an article on the AWS database blog about how you can achieve faster switchover for Amazon RDS blue-green deployments with a large number of connections. So I think we've spoken about blue-green deployments on the podcast before, John, but it might be worth doing a bit of a quick definition of RDS blue-green deployments
before
into this.
Yep, sure. So blue-green deployment, kind of what it says on the tin. It's not about holding your breath until you turn blue, but, you know, I've been known to do that once or twice. The idea being, and it's not specific to RDS, but the idea being that when you're doing a deployment, you bring up a new green instance of whatever it is you're deploying. That might be a Lambda, that might be your auto-scaling group, that might be, you know, an RDS instance, whatever. And you gradually shift your traffic from your blue instance, the old one, onto your green instance, the new one. And, you know, things like code deploy and what have you support that for scaling groups and Lambdas, and that kind of make that reasonably easy. It's less simple for RDS because of it's a lot less automated. There's options in the console and it will help you do that. But again, the downtime is still kind of minutes. It was not really properly blue green, because blue green arguably there's zero downtime because you've got old and new running in parallel and you're just gradually traffic shifting. That's the word. And that kind of works reasonably well. But they're talking here about, you know, dropping the switch over time. And obviously this makes sense in a database world, because gradual traffic shifts in a database world is not something that always works. Sometimes it does, depending on the change that you're making. Sometimes it doesn't, because you might have made a fairly major change, or you changed a critical table or something like that that everyone talks to. So in order to get everyone to have a nice experience, you just have to kick everyone out for a minute and then shift all the traffic to the new one and kind of go, boom, there you go. And arguably you're still blue green if you've got both of them up at the same time, rather than, you know, just killing the old one instant that you've got them both there, so you've still got that rollback option. This is quite a nice little article, because it talks about a way of cleaning up existing connections faster, so that way downtime for databases is funny, because existing connections don't necessarily get kind of knocked on the head, but new connections will be stopped. So what that basically means is you could have apparent downtime that's a lot longer than your actual downtime, because new people can't get to it, but you're still waiting for one very long running transaction to finish. And that's a problem. That is, that's a problem. And this is kind of showing you a way of speeding that process up, so you're not hanging around for quite so long waiting for things to clean up, waiting for things to tidy up. There is a really annoying kind of process to do this, and they sort of, you know, they've measured downtime and then they've enabled offline mode and kind of shoved everything across. It's well worth a read if it's something that you have to do, but equally if it's something that you have to do, you have my sympathy, because database management is no fun.
How about you, Ed? Is this something you have to get involved in?
Well, I have certainly worked on a project before that I think might even be using blue-green, though I think the Aurora flavor rather than the traditional RDS flavor. But in fact, maybe this is Aurora that is talking about, now that I look more closely at the article. So there we go. So maybe this is directly relevant. Yeah, I was kind of thinking, well, you know, surely if you're managing your database clients, as in your web nodes or whatever it is that's talking to your database, then does it matter that much, because you're going to, You're gonna stop traffic to them. You're gonna turn them off, whatever, and you're gonna have no connections anyway. But then, I was thinking, well, maybe if you're running something that does like connection pooling, it you might have a load of idle connections sitting around, and it's not going to fail over very quickly. And so maybe you do need some way of just speeding up that process of actually getting them all to disappear off, so that you can cleanly switch. So yeah, I mean, it seems like a sensible addition to the process. Yeah, like you said, John, it's one of those things you sort of imagine blue green as being, oh, that's zero downtime, but clearly there it does need to be a little bit of downtime here, no matter how you look at it, in order to actually enact that switch. But I guess it really depends upon how you're building that RDS blue green into your bigger picture of your release process, and exactly what change it is that you're making in order to need to do that blue green.
Yeah, because it's very possible you could do it such that you do it through config, and you push the config out to a gradual percentage so that new connections get the new version of everything. But that's that takes an awful lot of work to build versus the cloud provider has come up with a way of doing it for you to an extent.
Yeah.
This is also definitely an issue of scale, because digging into it a little bit, just above the offline mode header, it talks about the process of draining connections. Previously, it could take up to 60 seconds per 1,000 connections. So it's a scaling problem. With recent updates and by using offline mode specifically for MySQL, it's less than a few seconds for 15,000. So it's a scale problem. It's definitely, that's where this sort of sits.
Cool. Okay, let's move on then to everybody's favorite topic, AI. We got three articles in before we mentioned AI, but I'm not sure we've managed to do an episode recently without mentioning AI. But this is a slightly different angle on AI. This is all about the data centers required to power AI, because it does require a lot of compute power, and those computers have to sit somewhere. So this is an article from DetroitNews.com, which I don't think is a site that we've featured before, but there we are. It's one that came up on my news feeds anyway. So yeah.
I love a bit of local news. It's great.
But this article on DetroitNews.com is about how Amazon is betting $150 billion on data centers required for the AI boom. And I assume that they're going to be putting some of those in Detroit, hence the fact that it's on DetroitNews.com.
Should we put our hands up for Detroit?
Oh, I love this city.
Oh, go on then.
We need to dub the that tune over in case people don't know what you're talking about, but I knew what you were talking about.
It's usually you making the 80s jokes too, so
that was naughties.
Was,
it was naughties. Yeah, anyway, I have to look it up, but
I definitely feel not 80s,
but yeah. Anyway, so John, thoughts on Amazon betting $150 billion on AI data centers?
It feels like a disingenuous title for clicks. It's not a bet. They know that they're going to need the extra data centers, be that for AI or AN other compute that takes off. So it's not a bet. It's just a very clickbaity headline. And also, it's not 150, it's 148 if you go further down the article. So this is poor reporting from the Detroit News.
Oh, you round up numbers. You know, I would have rounded it up. I probably would have rounded up to 200.
Dearie me. It's interesting. It is, because they're obviously going to be expanding existing data centers. They're going to be building new ones, not just in Detroit, obviously, because it also talks about Saudi Arabia, which we didn't talk about, but there's a new data center they're building out there, and various parts of kind of Southeast Asia and areas where they don't have a great presence right now, and where it's also arguably a bit cheaper to run these sorts of things. Interestingly, and the article does pick on this, it does say that their planned outlay on server farms, which is a very old hat term now, but I still quite like it, dwarfs the public commitments from Microsoft and Google. But then, you know, Amazon like to talk about this sort of thing. Let's say we're spending this much money because rah, 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 rah. And then Microsoft goes off and says, yes, but we've made loads of money on M365, go away. So it's not a fair kind of thing to compare, but it's interesting. And we do quite often sort of forget, it's quite easy to forget that in spite of the cloud being this ephemeral, ethereal, auto-scaling, magical thing, it does still run in data centers, and you just need to actually build the damn things. I mean, it's a fairly unkind comparison, but I once wore a T-shirt that said, the cloud is just someone else's computer. It's a somewhat unkind comparison, but it's still kind of true. So you just need to build these things, and they cost a lot of money.
Serverless runs on servers in data centers. So
funny that. Who knew?
Before I ask you for your thoughts on this one, Ed, I did have a quick Google, and Put Your Hands Up for Detroit was released in 2006. So in my early noughties, noughties was about right. So
I was very anyway. Not listening to that in 2006.
Anyway, moving on from early noughties electronic dance music, what are your thoughts on this, Ed, this investment into AI data centers?
Well, I think you know, it's just another example of Amazon piling on the pressure and trying to keep pace in the AI sphere. Well, as you say, you know, it's obviously not purely AI, but I think AI is driving a lot of their growth at the moment. It's certainly what everyone is talking about, and everyone's trying it. So, at least in the short term, that's going to be what their demand is that they're dealing with. I think the main thing I always think about when it comes to all these data centers is how they're actually going to power them, and whether they are thinking sustainably and ensuring renewable energy. And they do mention renewable energy a bit in the article, so it's good that they haven't just greenwashed it completely. But I think Amazon do still have a fair way to go in terms of actually providing their data centers with properly green power. I think whilst they have spent a fair bit on renewable energy, it's not necessarily in the same place as the data centers, and therefore that it's more of an offset than actual avoiding the carbon emissions of those data centers. So an interesting one.
We've spoken about the renewables a fair bit on here, because there was a little while ago the whole they bought a lot of diesel generators for Irish data centers because they could get a credit if they could disconnect from the grid when they were asked to. Okay, not fine. The article does call out, and we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, the how do you pronounce that? The Susquehanna River nuclear plant that they've kind of repurposed, and that's a 40-year-old nuclear plant, but they're kind of keeping going with that, and big investments in solar, but again, that's credit purchase so far as we can work out. So it's interesting. In terms of data center cost, there's definitely two costs, and I think the one that gets reported on, because it's a nice big juicy number for the readers, is the build cost, because building a big building like that and buying a load of servers costs a lot of money. Running them is a lot less interesting, because you talk about daily and monthly and weekly run rates, and that's a lot less interesting because it's a smaller number.
Indeed, yeah, it's an interesting one. Well, I guess they get all of us AWS customers to pay our big bills, and that pays their big bills. So there we go.
Absolutely, as long as we keep on doing that, the world will continue to be a better place. So sticking with the subject of AI, but moving from the infrastructure layer into the model layer, the next article is on silicon.co.uk, and it's about Amazon's recent investment. So it's on silicon.co.uk, but you'll have seen this announcement on lots of different websites last week if you read the trade press. This is all about Amazon's latest investment into Anthropic. So they're already a fairly major investor in Anthropic. They've now pumped another $2.75 billion into Anthropic. So thoughts on this one, John?
Is it an additional, or is it just a completion of the vesting schedule that they'd previously spoken about that's just getting reported again? I'm not sure.
Could be.
Because whenever you spend that much money on something, it's never just it's not like to use a reasonably accessible analogy, it's not like buying a house where you send one Bax or Chaps payment to your solicitor for an eye-watering amount of money, and then a couple of days later they send one payment to another solicitor who just kind of moves some numbers around. It's kind of not like that, where it all happens on a day or two. It's over weeks to months because of things like vesting schedules, and they're not necessarily buying with cash and that kind of thing. So I wonder how much of this is just additional noise because they've completed the schedule of payments, versus is this actually new money? So I'm not sure it is new.
Yeah, definitely. Money. Well, they said they were going to invest $4 billion, and they invested 1.25. Now they've invested the other 2.75. So it's just saying we said we'd do it, and now we've done it. So yeah, you're kind of right in that respect.
Yeah, round of applause for all the accounts teams there, because that's a shed load of money.
It is a lot of money to move around, yeah. It is a lot of money to move around, but what do you think? Is it, you know, is it the right way to be spending that money in this current climate?
I think AWS have kind of been backed into a little bit of a corner with this. Is it the right way or the wrong way? I don't know. I'm an engineer. I don't run a business. I work in a business. I do engineering. And, you know, talk to our wonderful listeners. Please keep listening to me, because otherwise I'm just talking into the void. But yeah, as whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing, I don't know. But they've definitely been backed into a bit of a corner here, because Google and Microsoft made massive investments in GitHub Copilot and then in OpenAI for ChatGPT, you know, respectively. So they've kind of been forced into it, I think, to a great extent, because they've got kind of their own models that they've done. Okay, I've never worked with the Titan ones. I don't know if they're any good or not. And then Anthropic, I don't know, is it? I don't know how the conversation started, but it's, oh, here's another company that's looking for some money. There you go. Now we look a little bit more competent than we did before, because we own a stake in another company that does AI better than we do it.
Or okay, maybe we need to buy it before somebody else does.
Maybe. Yeah.
What are you seeing in this space, Ed? Are you seeing much demand around generative AI? I know AWS are making a lot of noise about it. Obviously, there's a lot of noise in the press about the investments that are being made. But what about on the client side? Are you seeing demand for this? Or are people just trying to figure out what all the hype is all about?
There's quite a lot of figuring out. And I think there's a reasonable amount of hype and demand just to sort of see what it is that people might be missing, and see if there is anything where it can be used to actually you know, improve the business in some way, make more money, whatever they want to do with it. It's not an area that I've actually managed to spend a lot of time yet. I'm much more comfortable dealing with you know, more traditional compute stuff than I am with this newfangled AI stuff. But yeah, you know, it does feel like it's the future in some way, and we're only going to see more of it. So yeah, definitely on my radar. Yeah, I certainly felt like this announcement was kind of just showing that they're trying to keep up with Microsoft and Google, really. From what I've heard from a few people that have had a play around with Claude, which is Anthropic's AI offering, is quite good at some things. So, you know, not necessarily the worst investment for Amazon to be making in the AI space. But whether they are able to keep up or let alone take over in some way from OpenAI remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think, is it Claude that you've been using, John, in your adventures in AI? So yeah, what we've discovered is Claude is very good at making stuff up. We don't want it to make stuff up. We just want it to...
I mean, to be fair, I gave it a temperature of 0.5, which is like half. And again, for the listeners, the temperature with AWS APIs for LLMs, temperature is a measure of how much randomness you want to inject, and that's kind of a proxy for how creative you want it to be. Between 0 and 1, so it's a percentage, but you know, out of 1, and 0.5 is I want you to be reasonably creative, half creative. So if you ask it to do something like a summary, you know, summarize, say, this conversation from a transcript, which I will ask it to do in a bit because that's kind of what I built, then you probably want a temperature that's fairly low, because I want you to tell me exactly what happened and give me a summary. If you want it to write a haiku, then perhaps you want it to be fairly creative, you know, or give me some product names or something like that. Marketing copy, maybe. Then maybe 0.8 or 0.9 is probably more appropriate. So it's not that it's inventing stuff. It's that you absolutely have to play and tune the model, and that can be a little bit expensive with very large input like this transcript, because of the payment, because of the charging model based on effectively per word.
Mm. And we say lots of those. So, but when we first started playing with it, it was making up jokes and attributing them to us. So completely random jokes that neither of us had said. So that was interesting. So definitely a little bit of tuning required to tune that out, because yeah, we say enough random stuff as it is without AI making up more random stuff for us. So anyway, on that note, we've reached the end of our time for Logicast Season 3, Episode 14. So thank you, John, as always, for your insights. And thank you, Ed, for joining us on the podcast. And you did a great job. You said that, you know, you're not so used to this podcasting and video stuff. Well done. You've done a fantastic job today on Logicast. So we've really enjoyed having you on. So that brings us to the end of this week's episode. So if you've enjoyed it, tell your friends. If you want to see what we look like when you're listening to us, you can also find us on YouTube, or you can just download us to listen to from wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with another episode of Logicast for you next week. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Cheers.